Well, I suppose for the purpose of the tape, I should introduce myself again. My name is John Avery, and I am an English teacher at the University of Petroleum and Minerals, which is a Saudi university, totally operated by the Saudis, in the on the eastern side of Saudi Arabia. Just to take a look at the map, a general perspective is Israel is here, Egypt, Iran, India would be down in this area, and this is the eastern coast of Africa here. And Saudi Arabia juts out as a peninsula, it's referred to as the Arabian Peninsula, and we are right on the Gulf. On here it says Persian Gulf. It said before they referred to it as Arabian Gulf. I am at the area where the oil fields are, where the oil, in fact, the first oil well was on the university campus, which was just barren land before oil, and now it's become a small metropolitan area. And the name of the city that I'm in.
I notice you thinking.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty great. Maybe
your wife can do that, but I'm not sure anybody else can.
She's always thinking, I'm thinking, don't I? Of course, there's a public persona and a private reality. Now, they can say all this, but then it really gets watered down to very little.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we're able, I mean, if they lived up to all this, that would be impossible to live in.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of new about Islam, the general introduction to the subject, and today I thought it necessary, if we're really going to look at the religion, we have to talk about its founder, Muhammad, who he was, and how that defines the religion. So, any questions to begin with at all? Okay. Muhammad was born in the year 570 AD. Now, I should say right away that you may be interested to know that this is not the year 1980, but it's actually the year 1406. the Muslim peoples have their own calendar, which they call a Hijri calendar, and it doesn't even start with the year of Muhammad's birth, as we start with the year of Christ's birth, but it starts with a point in his ministry, which we'll refer to. And so if we in Saudi Arabia have to operate within that calendar, although most of the time it's they say this is the 10th day of Muharram, 1406, corresponding to September 5th, 1986. So we deal with two calendars all the time. But in one way, I think it's very instructive to think of it as the year 1406, if we're talking about the Islamic world, because in that way, if we correspond to a history of the Christian Church and a history of Western civilization, I think in some ways the Islamic world is pre-Renaissance, they seem to be in a medieval mindset in a lot of ways, and I think that's part of the religion, but just seeing it in that way of being about 600 years ago, or whatever, yeah, about 600 years ago, is somewhat instructive. All right, anyway, in our year, 570, then, he was born in the city of Mecca. Now, Mecca, at that time, was a trading center and a religious center. And the situation in the world was that, I should display this larger map just for purpose, because I think it's helpful to see the setting into which he was born. And the setting is this king. A new world map.
accurately displays the size of the continents, so it may be somewhat different. Africa appears enormous. Anyway, in the year 570, the Roman Empire had by that time split into Rome and Byzantium, which was ruled from Constantinople, now Istanbul. And actually, the Roman half had fallen, and the Byzantines controlled this area extending halfway through the Middle East. The other empire of great strength was the Persian Empire, now mainly Iran, which controlled this area and here. And Saudi Arabia, really, throughout history, has been an isolated land area because, for all intents and purposes, it hasn't been worth the trouble to invade it. It's just been desert, and it still would be that way. It still would be an isolated area if it weren't for oil. And it's very inaccessible, inaccessible only by camel in those days, and mainly these people dealt with horses and chariots and so on. So for the most part, it was just the people in this area paid royalties to either to the Persian King of Kings or to the Roman Emperor in Constantinople, and didn't. There was no direct occupation, and alliances would switch depending on the personality of the king or the emperor and the specific tribes in the region. So it was an area of great dispute, it was an area of great concern. But as far as trading, the ships would come in from Asia, and instead of going, you can get through here at this strait, and go up into the Red Sea and sail up to Cairo, or Suez anyway, and bring goods that way. But apparently the Red Sea was known for its treacherous coral reefs. So what would happen is the ships would dock down here in what's now Yemen, and in fact is the area that the Queen of Sheba is supposed to have come from, and carry the goods overland on a caravan route. And one of the crossroads of their route was the city of Mecca. Now, therefore, the people from Mecca were known as traders, and they would divide, the goods would come down from Europe and those regions, and then would go out this way, and also come up from Asia and go out that way, and Mecca was kind of a crossroads, and different caravans would come into it and go out. So, that was the role of Mecca in those days. And Medina, another town up here, also played a role, not quite as large as Mecca. Religiously, before Islam, Saudi Arabia wasn't that heavily affected by Judaism or Christianity. There were Christians and Jews living in the region, but they weren't dominant by any means. And the tribes of Arabia were more or less idol worshippers, and Mecca was a religious center long before Islam. There was a history of it being a religious center. And in Mecca there is this Kaaba, which is this ancient cubic building where there were different idols and stones and objects of worship. Now, this turns out to be the thing that Muhammad was most opposed to. So he was born in that area at the time to the family of the Quraysh, which was a trading family. And they not only traded in the goods coming from Asia, but they also traded in the religious pilgrimage. They determined which goods could be sold within the region of the city. They said that no impure goods could be sold in that region, and you couldn't bring things into it. So, in other words, you had to buy their food, which was at exaggerated prices. And the same with clothing. You couldn't come in and worship in that region with impure, unholy clothing, so you had to either
buy their clothing or go and worship in your clothing, and then you couldn't leave with it and you had to buy theirs at that point, or you had to leave your clothing outside and go in naked and worship and then come out. So they kind of had a stranglehold on the religious rites and worshiping of that time. So Muhammad was born into this family that was part of that, and throughout his life he had conflict with them because there was a vested interest politically and economically in defending that trade, this idol-worshipping trade. So at the time that he was born, the two empires, the Byzantium Empire and the Persian Empire, had been in struggle against each other, and all throughout his life they had been in struggle. So they didn't have really a strong influence on Arabia. They were more occupied in other areas that were more lucrative for them. Some of the shrines, as I said, contained objects of worship. They would worship stones or trees or wells, water wells, become very significant in that part of the world. And a lot of these habits of some of these stones and wells, it's amazing because some of those habits have transferred to Islam today, even though Muhammad spoke strongly against idol worship. Now, it's not unusual for a religion to adapt local customs into its habits. I mean, in Christianity, for example, at Christmas, we have the Christmas tree and a lot of the habits that are pre-Christian. But the Muslims seem very adept at doing that and in some way using it for political purposes to win over the local population. So to get back to Muhammad, he was born into this tribe. His father died before he was born, and his mother died at the age of 6. But he never really was with his mother because it was a habit at that time to send out the children to the outside of Mecca, outside of the dirty, dusty area of Mecca, to the local, what we call Bedouin tribes, the nomadic tribes that would wander around finding feed for their camel in the different grassy areas. So he wasn't really raised by mother or father, so he was an orphan. And after his mother died, he was passed on to his grandfather, who lived only for 2 years, and then to his uncle. So in Islam, there is a strong concern for widows and orphans. And I think, and a lot of people think, that it comes from this experience of Muhammad. It is said he was illiterate. Now, this point may be negligible, except for the fact that this whole book, the Quran, was written by Muhammad. Now, the point that he was illiterate is very important to Muslims because if he was illiterate, then it has to be revelation. He couldn't have written it on his own. It had to have come totally through God and be received by him. And he couldn't have read it. A large part of the Quran has a reinterpretation, really, of the Jewish and Christian scriptures. If you are a Muslim and you believe that, then you believe that Muhammad didn't know that information ahead of time and it had only come as revelation to him. We see it as an adaptation of our scriptures and a twisting of them. For example, they say that Jesus really didn't die on the cross, that there was kind of an apparition. It is inconceivable for Muslims to have a great leader like Jesus be in a position of folly, be in a position of, what can we say, embarrassment or being overpowered. To them, a leader is the powerful, the mighty. And so it's inconceivable for them to see Jesus in that way. And consequently, their revelation is that he wasn't crucified, but that someone was crucified in his place and that he actually just ascended to heaven. So that's one example of the change of how they've changed the scriptures. So to return, he then was in that region and raised by this uncle of his, and he was around the holy area in Mecca, because his grandfather was supposed to be the caretaker of the religious shrines. And he was married, I'm not sure what year he was married, but anyway, before he was married, he was suggested by friends to this lady, this widow, Khadija, to conduct some of her caravans. She was a wealthy widow, had caravans that went up to Damascus and other centers at that time, and he took some of these caravans and went up there, and apparently was an astute businessman and dealt very well with them. And she was so impressed with him that they got married. Now that was a good marriage for Muhammad and a poor marriage for her, because he was a penniless boy, a penniless orphan, and she was a wealthy widow. And at any rate, despite this difference of position, social status, they had, it seems, a very successful marriage, and successful in their term. She believed in him, and she strongly supported him, and she was a mainstay behind his belief in himself as prophet and as receiving the revelation of God. And so at about the year 610, Muhammad is said to have received his revelation. The first revelation came to him, and he was before that time prone to meditate. And Mecca is surrounded by hilly areas and with a lot of caves, and he was known to be kind of a mystic, a recluse, would go up into the caves and meditate on his own. And and he is said to have received the revelation from the angel Gabriel to proclaim the word of God to his fellows. And this is the beginning of Muhammad as the prophet, Muhammad as the revealer of God's word. And he felt that he was the final prophet in the long line of monotheistic faith. At that time, the main issue, and still is in Islam, is a struggle of polytheism, the belief in many gods, against monotheism, the belief in one God. And this is what we have in common as Christians with Islam. They are very, very stern about this issue of there is only one God, and there are no other gods. And it was because Muhammad was reacting against the polytheism of his day, of worshiping different items of springs and stones, as I've said. And so he believed that he received this revelation, and there's in the Quran, there's the Quran is a rather difficult, a very difficult book to read, but for example, it's arranged not by chronological order or by any theological order, but by the length of the chapters, which are called surahs, from the longest to the shortest. So naturally you start at the end and you work to the beginning. And not only in that, but it's very difficult, the logic and the development of the presentation is very difficult to read. And all of it, this whole book, as I said, which is no mean feat, is supposed to have come from Muhammad. And whereas our scriptures, of course, were revealed to many, many people. I just want to read quickly this. Yes, this is the night, they call it the night of power. In the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate, which, by that way, that phrase, which in Arabic is Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, means in the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate, and it starts everything, every lecture, every dictum from the government is supposed to have that at the top. Anyway, we be... No, we don't in my classes, of course, but it's not expected of us. But when Saudis speak with one another, they are supposed to begin with that. We behold that we sent it down on the night of power, and what shall teach thee... The wording is very awkward. And what shall teach thee what is the night of power? The night of power is better than 1,000 months. It is the angels and the spirits descend by the leave of their Lord upon every command. Peace it is till the rising of dawn. So this night of power was the first revelation that Muhammad was supposed to have received. And it was his calling to begin. And at this point, it seems that Muhammad was a sincere mystic, really concerned with the oneness of God, with knowing God. And many people agree with this, that he started out by wanting to call his people to an honorable relationship with the one Creator God. Now, I said that there were many gods in the Kaaba, in the tribal religions of the area, but they still believed in a main god, a more powerful one than others. And his name was Allah. And what Muhammad did then was to focus on that one God and eliminate all the others. So there was a sense of a more powerful God, but he made it the only one, the exclusive one. And it's at this point that if anyone was looking at Islam to see if, you know, they want to accept it as a religion or not, that you would have to decide whether you believe Muhammad was really a sincere prophet of God. Now, it's if you do, then you accept the whole revelation. And because he is a prophet of God, all words given to him then are the revelation of God, and they become infallible. You have to follow them. It's a non-choice situation. So once he set himself up as God's prophet, then his word became law. He became the judge and the arbitrator of not only religious theology, but of life and action in every sense. And such it is with Islam today. Strict Islam sticks to Muhammad as the person from whom everything came. There are no other prophets. The Muslims' conception of Jesus and of the Old Testament prophets is totally through Muhammad's eyes, what he saw as revelation. But he basically had a simple message. There is one God, and Muhammad is a prophet, his prophet, and they must repent, give up their idol of worship, their licentious ways, or be condemned to hellfire. It's the traditional prophetic message. Repent and worship God. And a lot of his teaching, though we see it as antiquated and somewhat barbaric, particularly in the treatment of women today, was quite radical at the time. He told people to trade honestly, treat women fairly, and he is said to be a kind man in spirit and nature, at least at this point of his ministry. So he first saw himself as a reformer and restorer of the monotheistic faith. Now, a restorer because he thought that the Jews and the Christians, all originally receiving true revelation, had distorted that revelation. For example, the doctrine of the Trinity, he thought was actually a doctrine of polytheism, where instead of having one God, Christians then believed in the Pauline sense of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, of three gods, which in strict Islam is anathema. And so he eliminated that in his perception of God, and there was thus only one God. And of course, his way of seeing it was the one way of seeing it. Now, he was not a popular man to begin with. he was, first of all, going against the and the political and religious establishment at the time. He had very few followers. His wife, for a period of time, was his only real follower, and even those in his family didn't believe in him. But he must have had a very charismatic personality, that's the only way I can think to describe it, a very hot conception, and as a mystic, and I think we've been exposed to mystics before, their perceptions can be enveloping, and I just think of people in our time that have followed others like Jim Jones and so on, that totally see things within the perception of that one man, whether he's right or wrong. So anyway, his mission was not well received. He went through a real low period, and in fact his wife died, his main supporter died in 619, and the group of Muslims that he had converted received so much persecution that they had to be sent over to what is now Ethiopia. But in 620, he received what is called a night journey, in which he is said to have traveled either mystically or, some believe, literally, from Mecca to Jerusalem. And this is the reason why Jerusalem is said to be the third holiest city in Islam, because Muhammad was supposed to have gone there and received more revelations, and God had rejuvenated him at that point. So with this kind of renewed faith, after his night journey, he came into contact with people from the city of Medina. Now, Medina is further up in the mountains. It's up here. Quite a ways at that time when you're traveling across harsh desert. And the two cities really didn't have a whole lot to do with one another. But the Medinese, I guess, they had heard him speak, and they invited him to come and be a leader in Medina to kind of bring together the different factions. He didn't have there the image of being the iconoclast, of fighting against the economic and religious vested interests. So he went to Medina. It wasn't a choice he wanted to make. It wasn't a voluntary one, but it was a necessary one, because he wasn't really getting anywhere with his preaching in Mecca. So he went up to Medina, and he is said to have, the believers who were following him at the time were said to have left Mecca very slowly so as not to be caught and persecuted. And in a famous scene, Ali, and he becomes very important in the development of Islam, who was his son-in-law and also nephew, stayed in his bed one night so that the Meccans would believe he was still there while Muhammad escaped. And so he went to Mecca, to Medina, and he set up a community there and was the ruler, the judge, the lawgiver. And the nature, and all of this time, the revelations kept coming to him. And the nature of these revelations changed, and so did the focus, from less theology about the nature of God to more about obedience to social and legal issues to deal with. And here a lot of the dictates about how you wash before prayers. And Islam is very much a system of rules to the people that is very tightly controlled about what is to be done and what's not to be done. For example, they don't eat pork, they don't drink alcohol, and so on. And a lot of these rules were laid down during the time that Muhammad was in Medina. And he grew in strength. His community grew in strength. And he still very much had the sense that he wanted to go to Mecca and establish his base there. And at the time that he went to Medina, he saw himself as very much in the tradition of being carrying on and restoring the monotheistic faith. But he was rejected by the Jews. The Jews were said to have made up half or more the population of Medina. And they didn't accept his revelation. They mocked him. And it is at this time that I think that there was a major change in Muhammad's direction, where he became very much now a power broker, a community leader, and he changed a lot of things. For example, the direction that the Muslims were supposed to pray was supposed to be towards Jerusalem, and this is an unchanging thing, but he changed that now towards Mecca. So his focus was going towards Mecca. He changed the Sabbath from Saturday to Friday, and some say he changed it to Friday because that's when the Jews need to buy things in the store. So if things were closed down, it made it very difficult for them to observe the Sabbath. And he incorporated some of the traditions of the Kaaba in Mecca. So then he changed the direction of Islam entirely, away from geographically. Theologically, away from a Judeo-Christian faith, more toward an Arabian creed. He consolidated his power in Medina and used it as a base to then start what has continued to be in Islam a military faith. He invaded some of those caravans that still continued from Mecca up to Damascus and the other parts north. And he invaded those, and thus there was a real rivalry now, not only religious economic, but now an actual military rivalry between Muhammad and the Medinese and the Meccans. And the outcome of this is that there was a battle, the Battle of Badr, in which Muhammad's troops were by far inferior in number, but they had a famous victory there. And there were a number of confrontations, with the eventual result that Muhammad was able to walk into Mecca, destroy all the idols in the holy areas, and establish Islam as the one religion of Arabia. And as a result of this, the tribes of Arabia started to pay him duty instead of the old emperors and kings that they had in the past. He didn't force people to believe in Islam. A common perception of Islam is that he lived by the sword and died by the sword. You know, the old thing of going up to someone, do you believe? And if you don't, you slash off their heads. That generally was not the case. But if people did believe in Islam, there were economic incentives for doing so. They could be part of the duty received from the tribes. So within his lifetime then, he had transferred the disparate beliefs of the Arabian people, given them the Quran, which has become the basis of their language, and changed the language radically in a number of ways, and becomes now classical Arabic, and gave them a political cohesiveness that was to draw them together and to make them a world force. And within the next 100 years after the death of Muhammad, he died in 632, within the next 100 years after that, the Islamic world had spread across Africa, up into Spain, and across Persia, and had totally changed the power balance of the world. And religiously, of course, he gave them a whole new perception of seeing God. And that's Muhammad, as I understand him. Now, that's a very quick and brief view of him. It should be said, in all fairness, that he died not a rich man. He never really wanted that. But he died a very accomplished man who had accomplished his goals, both religiously and politically. He's been seen throughout history by Christian historians as a heretic, of course, a fanatic who was a faker, who was only after political gain. It's even said that because when he received the revelations, he would fall down and shake and so on and sweat, that he was an epileptic and that he was just a madman. But I think we'd be doing ourselves damage to see him only in that light, that he is the one founder of Islam, which is a tremendously powerful force and a tremendously cohesive force in the world today, and a very important one. Whether we agree with it or not, it's still very important that it's a very powerful force, especially with the dependency upon oil. And that part of the world is a very critical and very fiery part of the world, as we all know. And we need to understand Islam and not see it merely as a deviant religion, but as a force in its own right. Although religiously I can't agree with it a whole lot. Yeah.
You said that you had revelations, people who left their religion illiterate.
Right.
And revelations came through some sort of system. How did the Quran get this?
Right. Then what he said he had received from God was written down on scraps of animal hides or bones or whatever they could write on at that time. So yeah, there were different sectarians or scribes that had written it down. So it was recitation. In fact, the disagreement about how it should be translated. Here it says, this is the surah that's supposed to have told him the word from the angel Gabriel, recite. In some translations it says write, but Muslims object to that. They said it is recite. Say what God has said to you.
How do they know it's Gabriel?
Well, that's just what he said.
Oh, that's
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, right. Everything comes through him, the whole thing. I mean, if he was a total charlatan or a sincere man, depends on the nature of the whole religion depends on how you perceive Muhammad.
Reminds me of the Joseph Smith. Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of correlations. In fact, you wonder if Joseph Smith didn't read a history of Islam before he started coming out with his revelations, because there are a lot of correlations, you know, even down to the angel Gabriel, which Smith claims gave him the revelations on the golden tablets, and down to the number of wives and all of that. Right. Tomorrow I want to talk about the main theological thing. Try to go into that and how some of those have changed. And then that will be tomorrow, and then on Thursday will be more of a historical perspective of exactly what happened in the expansion, the development there, and how that the division of Islam between the Shiites and the Sunnis has extended to our day, and is very critical in our understanding of Iran, Iraq, the Lebanon situation, and Syria and Libya and all of that. So, and then on Friday I want to kind of give a response, Christian response of how we can compare our religion with theirs. Yeah.
What a foreign student or Muslim student that you meet have like Ali, do you know what I mean? Do you say that with a friend?
Yes. Right.
Would that be so important to say you find his name?
Ali was the founder then of the schism, the Shiites.
Oh.
See, and I'll be getting more into this on Thursday, but when Muhammad died, he didn't designate a specific leader to take over after him. And the Arabs are, by their nature, very much focused on one man, very much personality focus. Whereas in our country, we have as the basis of our government, our way of life, the Constitution. So that the system then is more important than the man who inhabits the office of the presidency, for example. In Islam, or in the Arab world, or that part of the world, the person becomes very important and is able to mobilize support. So that there was no one set person to take over after Muhammad. He hadn't designated that. And he didn't set up any means for choosing that person. And so that there was, right from the beginning, or right from the beginning after Muhammad, a real dissension about who should now be the leader. And it was important to have one leader. Not so much a religious leader, but a leader on temporal issues. So this person became known as the Caliph. And many thought that Ali should have been that leader, right from the beginning, because he was close to Muhammad. He had been there and helped Muhammad escape from physical peril and so on. But he was bypassed. And there were three caliphs before him, which were very significant in the development of Islam. And finally, he became the fourth caliph, or the fourth main leader. And he was eventually assassinated as well. Were a number of others. And his son, Hassan, was too. So the followers, and then the caliphate went back to the more politically controlling group. And from that point, the followers of Ali became known as the Shiites, the followers who believed that Ali and his descendants, not just the politically expedient choice, but his descendants should be the caliphs, the temporal controllers of Islam. And the Sunnis are basically the people who believe whoever was chosen as caliph was the appropriate one because he needed to be at that moment. So that extends to today. And then the Shiites then are those who often have Ali in their name. Although Ali is important, Ali as the son-in-law of Muhammad, it was important to all Muslims, but particularly important to the Shia.
Why did Muhammad die?
A natural death. I didn't focus, it's in here, but just basically natural death. Yeah. Actually quite old for that. Yeah. That time, 60, in the 60s was... Yeah. Yes. This is what I was talking about, the night journey, when he was supposed to have been transferred from Mecca to Jerusalem. It was supposed to have all taken place in the night. And actually what is required for Muslims to believe is that it was a journey of the spirit, but many people believe in the literal translation that he actually traveled. It would have been through the air in one night to Jerusalem and back to Mecca.
So that ascension was not after his death?
No. In fact, he's buried in Medina.
The
prophet
focused on Ali for his personality focus. So it explains the role of the Ayatollah.
Very much so. Very much. The Shiites believe that after the death of Ali's son, there are a number of leaders or imams that were a leader of the Shiites up until there are differences in the number, but most of them believe up to the 12th imam, and that he is still in existence in the world and regardless of the fact that he'd have to be over 1,000 years old. And that he will be coming back to power. And Ayatollah Khomeini isn't seen as that imam, but he's seen in the role of the strong personal leader. And that's why, indeed, so many Shiites are willing to give their allegiance to one particular leader. It does become a personality cult from our perspective.
Assuming the votes kind of on the west, like in Morocco,
well, most of Saudi Arabia is Sunni. It's only in the eastern province, the area that I happen to live in, that there are Shiites. Mainly the Shiites are in Iraq. About half the population of Iraq is Shiite. And Iran is the main center. It is the official religion of Iran. But Shiites are only about 10% of the Muslim population. No, all you have to do is say Muhammad, there is one God, there is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet, and believe it, and you become a Muslim. No, you have to say it in the company of other Muslims to recognize them. It's easy to make the proclamation, it's difficult to follow.
On that score, maybe as an aside, what's the attraction to Muslim religion, to Black Catholics?
Oh, well, it was seen as a means of black power, I think. I'm not really up on that. Malcolm X? No.
Yeah.
Was he the black Muslim leader? It was seen, I believe, in a large degree, as a reaction to white Christian church. And it was a means of strong power, a way of rejecting the Christian tradition and the white tradition, particularly the whites. Now, why Muhammad Ali and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and all of these others have gone for it, I really don't know. But I know that there is a movement in the black, there is within the black Muslims now a movement to not be racist. They've seen themselves as racist, and they want to extend out to increase the conversion of Christians into Islam, or anybody into Islam, to include other races. So. Islam is a very, very active religion. There are more people becoming Muslim. It is the fastest growing religion in the world. Much faster than Christianity, I believe. And they are they're established. The thing that I object to is they are very vocal about wanting to establish mosques and centers of learning and teaching in Christian countries in Europe, and I believe one was recently built in Washington, whereas they won't allow people to establish Christian churches in Saudi Arabia. They profess a belief in tolerance. They're supposed to be the tolerant religion of other religions. But in actual practice, it doesn't work out that way. Perhaps it does in other countries. People say to me, you can't take Saudi Arabia as a typical place of a typical Muslim country, that they are much too austere and strict there. But it seems to me that if you're going to judge a religion on its founders and on the original basis of why it was established, that Saudi Arabia is pure, traditional, orthodox Islam, with all the intolerance that goes along with it. And that's what I react to, and of course that's what I know. Let me just read to you a letter. And these, I'll pass these around, or just have them up here if you're interested in it. But these are different dictums from the government handed out to different agencies. I just was handed them by a friend who was interested in them. One is a newspaper clipping by the Virtue Panel, wanting to establish virtuous behavior in our part of the country. This is a circular to companies, establishments, and hotels in the Eastern Province, and it's from the General Presidency Committee for the Promotion of Vice and the Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice. Excuse me. It is well known in this country that this country is ruled, praise be to God, by a wise policy based upon the Book of God and on the Prophet, peace be upon him. This policy forbids completely any words, actions, or beliefs incompatible with the teachings of Islam. With the approach of the new Christian year, 1985, we direct attention to the fact that the laws in this country do not permit the holding of any Christmas or New Year's parties or any holidays which contradict the teachings of Islam. It is also forbidden to promote these holidays. Now, that's the official word. And, in fact, there is no public recognition of Christmas at all, and I'm required, if it doesn't happen to fall on a weekend, to work on Christmas and New Year's and Easter. But the actual practice is they pretty much leave us to our own. They don't try to infiltrate our homes and find out who our Christians are practicing. As long as we don't try to indoctrinate or convert Muslims, which I'm not led to do, so overtly. Yes. We worship basically in home churches. Home groups will get together. And for Christmas, we got together and read some scriptures and sang some songs. So, in some ways, it's very much like the New Testament church. Growing up in a hostile environment, forced to come together and not come together as Christians upon traditional or denominational lines. Very international. Most of the people in our group are not American. They're Ghanaians and from Africa and Taiwanese and Europeans and so on. And so we're together because we believe in Jesus and we want to celebrate that. You're welcome to look at some of the stuff. Take a look at the Quran. I have, in fact, a tape here, if anybody's interested in it, by Cat Stevens, who now calls himself Yusuf Islam. He converted to Islam after a lot of searching around. It might be of interest to anybody to listen to that. And Yusuf Islam. Yusuf is a common surname. I want to say Christian name, but first name. It's kind of like the black athletes converting and then changing the name. You know, the Well Sender changing the cream and the bar. And so if you want to listen to that, you can. And take a look at any of this information.